family occasions. I know that the conversations can become quite animated and in some cases very dramatic. And if you throw in a couple glasses of whiskey or beer or wine, then it can become even psychodramatic, as in something out of a poorly supervised therapy session. Now, it may feel easy and condescending to dismiss people whose beliefs may not appear to be as, quote, enlightened as we would like to think of ourselves, or as progressive as we are, and to look down upon them. However, this is not productive, and in all truth, it's not loving. It can be fun, though. I begin with the premise that most of our family members are people of goodwill, people who are deeply committed to their traditions, even if they're not ours, whether they're Muslim, Catholic, a variety of Protestant, Jewish, evangelical, Christian, all of them are loving people. They're people who are dear to us. Now, this came to mind recently as I was reading an article in the Alumni Journal from the University of Chicago Divinity School. The author, Paul Mendes Flohr, is a professor of Jewish thought. His article was titled, "The Promise and Limitations of Interfaith Dialogue." Now, it's very pertinent, particularly at this time of the year. According to Mendes Flohr, we often retreat to a lowest common denominator by adopting positions such as, all religions say the same thing, every religion has some intrinsic value and is of equal moral and spiritual value. Now, while this sounds nice and kumbaya-ish, I don't think that many of us really believe this is true. It's as inane as that remark that all religions say the same thing. They don't. You know that, I know that. That's why we have thousands of different religions. When it comes to religious commitments, we have made choices about what we hold sacred. And people in the church down the street, or the synagogue across town, or the temple across the community are equally committed to their faith traditions. They have made those decisions, just as we have. And we need to honor our differences. These choices guide how we live our lives and cannot simply be equivocated down or reduced to that lowest common denominator. Even though that may feel accepting, it's not being honest. These choices guide how we live our lives. They guide how our family members live theirs. They guide how our neighbors choose to live theirs as well. When we dismiss the differences, we're cheapening their commitments and ours. Then this board is going to remind us that whether we're dealing with Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Christians, Hindus, and even Navajo snake dancers, their humanity is refracted through the particularity of their community of faith. Yet one must acknowledge that religious faith, especially a biblical or theistic inspiration, may engender intolerance. The claim to privileged knowledge often instills hubris and contempt for other faiths. Indeed, historically, the liberal ethic of tolerance was born of a resolve to contain the fury and wrath aroused by conflicting religious claims. Now, Mendes Flohr's article resonated with ideas that I encountered in Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind, why good people are divided by religion and politics. Near the end of Haidt's book, he tells us, if you want to understand another group, follow the sacredness. Now, I chose that for my title because what we hold sacred matters. It provides us with moral guideposts, boundaries, and reference points. It shapes the perspective that we use to address life's most profound questions. It's why we provide financial support to this congregation and faith community. It's why I believe that every Sunday morning should be seen as an opportunity to proclaim and speak about Unitarian Universalism and not to use it as some maudlin show and tell. What we do is serious. It matters. I was also intrigued by the way that Haidt shows how sacredness applies to both religion and politics. We have our religious tribes, and we also have our political ones. We also have who we are as people underneath our religious and political garments. Whether we refer to it as conscience or speak of it as that still small voice within, it is who we are at the very core of our being. I want to stress this because another point that Haidt makes that is germane to our discussion is that people often make their moral decisions intuitively rather than rationally. Think of some of the moral decisions that you've had to make. Did you have to spend a lot of time reasoning through them? Or were you pretty sure about where you wanted to go with it from the start? And then you rationalized it. You found reasons to support your arguments or your decision. Haidt says that we do these decisions, we make these decisions intuitively. And he goes on to support his argument very rationally and convincingly. He backs it up with various cross-cultural studies. Now, I also want to stress that while intuition may come as an immediate or gut reaction, this does not mean that it's unformed or uninformed. That's why there are differences in our intuitive decisions. And that's why there are differences between the intuitive decisions made by children and adults. As we experience life, we change, hopefully. We learn more, and that gut reaction has been formed. We know why we're making this decision. Now, staying with the psychological analogy, the best therapists, are often the ones who say that their methodology is eclectic. Whether they've been trained as Freudian psychoanalysts, Jungian psychoanalysts, Rogerian therapists, or Gestalt therapists modeling after Fritz Perls, or any other number of therapeutic methodologies, the best ones have a sense of who they are and work from that. But sure, they use the methodologies, but they're not chained to them. They're not restricted by them. They're not constrained by them. They're able to go with the person that they're dealing with and help. Well, the same thing can be said of our intuitions. When we make decisions intuitively, we're doing them based on our life experiences. We begin with our family backgrounds. We work with our moral teachings, the religious teachings that we have perhaps as children. But in most cases, they're not the same. They've changed over the years as we've had life experiences. We add the influences of perhaps having a gay child, a sibling with an interfaith, interracial, or multicultural international marriage. We begin with our neighborhoods of origin, but intuitively, as we grow and become adults, we move on to the neighborhoods that we're in. We learn, perhaps become more tolerant. Our taste, our spiritual taste become more eclectic. Or, unfortunately, as we see in some situations, we can become more hardened in our positions. But it all depends on what we hold sacred. That's why I said, follow the sacred. What do you hold sacred? What does that person sitting across the table hold sacred? Think of the parent who disowns their child, or the sibling who refuses to be near family members anymore. The one who persists in calling their child a pervert. As the late Rodney King would have said, it's not easy getting along. In The Righteous Mind, Jonathan Haidt tells us, when I was a teenager, I wished for world peace. But now I yearn for a world in which competing ideologies are kept in balance. Systems of accountability keep us all from getting away with too much. And fewer people believe that righteous ends justify violent means. Not a very romantic wish, but one that we might actually eventually achieve. Haidt's words are sanguine and pertinent at this time. They provide us with some perspective and insight as we look at what's going on with our national government. We look at it and see why we're having such difficulty getting along. And it's hard to come to that acceptance, but there are people who are very hardened in their positions and don't want to get along. That's why we have different parties and different ideologies, as well as different religions. Again, what do they hold sacred? Follow the sacred. It's also one of the reasons why it's imperative that we maintain a secular form of governance rather than one that allows any one religious position or ideology to take control. We can't have a religion that says, this is what we believe in, and all of you have to live by it. We can't have companies that say, I don't care if your religion allows you to engage in contraception. Mine says it's wrong. And since I'm paying your health insurance premiums, you go by what I said. We can't have a religion that says, abortion is totally wrong. All forms of birth control are wrong. We're not going to allow them. It's not compassionate. That's why we need a secular form of government. Mendes Flores is aware of this, and he tells us, actually, he raises a question. Are monotheistic faiths, grounded as they are in historical revelation, embodying propositional truth inherently incapable of genuine tolerance. Or monotheistic faiths constitutionally antagonistic to religious pluralism. Pretty strong language coming from a Jewish scholar. Monotheistic faiths. God says this. We have to believe. Is that right? I don't think so. How are we going to live together in this world? How are we going to coexist with those who would not accept the validity of our beliefs? Those who do not tolerate our commitment to a just and compassionate society? Those who would deprive people of their rights because of their race, their land of birth, or sexual orientations? Should we tolerate the intolerable? The French writer Gabriel Marcel tells us that we must immediately distinguish between two different cases. A case according to which I personally adopt a position contrary to the one expressed by the behavior which must be tolerated, and a different case in which I maintain a state of neutrality, i.e. of indifference with respect to both this position and its contrary. To put it in country and Western music lingo, Kenny Rogers echoed this sentiment in his song The Gambler when he said, "You've got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them, and we might add, know when to stop tolerating." You can't always just tolerate. Remember, another word that is frequently used as a synonym for tolerate is suffer. Some might say that tolerance can become a form of suffering when people are allowed to have their way unquestioned. It's also important to keep in mind these words from philosopher David Hyde, as he tells us in his book on toleration. We do not tolerate opinions and beliefs or even actions and practices. Only subjects holding disliked beliefs are the agents of detested actions. Tolerance consists exactly in the shift from the perspective of judging beliefs and actions impersonally to focusing on persons. Only human beings can be the object of restraint based on respect, which is required by the idea of tolerance. We tolerate one another. We don't tolerate bigotry. We don't tolerate racism. We stand up and counter it. Hyde's quote reminds me of the old television show, All in the Family. Perhaps some of you watched it. In the show, Archie Bunker was the beloved bigot. Now, you were able to love him as a person no matter how much you detested his bigotry and his intolerance. In the therapeutic community, there is a statement: love the person, not the pathology. However, our difference, our challenge, is not to see these differences as pathologies. They are, in fact, the other person's most deeply held convictions in some cases. And that's where the difficult part comes in. When we acknowledge that what is sacred to the other person, and then we have to make our own decisions about how to respond, whether to tolerate the bigotry and be quiet, or to speak up. I think of that hymn, "Once to every soul and nation comes the moment to decide." You know, in a civilized society, the way that this takes place is through exploration and dialogue. When we do so, we must keep in mind that the other person is probably as committed to her or his position as we are to ours. Jonathan Haidt also cautions us to be careful not to replicate the mistake that we often accuse religious conservatives of committing, where he writes, "Beware of anyone who insists that there is one true morality for all people, times, and places, particularly if their morality is founded upon a single foundation. Human societies are complex. Their needs and challenges are variable. Anyone who tells you that all societies in all eras should be using one particular moral matrix, resting on one particular configuration of moral foundations, is a fundamentalist of one sort or another." So we might add, there are probably liberal fundamentalists just as there are conservative fundamentalists. All of us can become enchanted by our ideologies. When we follow the sacred, we get at the roots of our differences. We begin to see why some people find specific foods abhorrent. Others find different sexual orientations or behaviors repugnant. And others would have us obey their Sabbaths while we work on ours. We also realize that what is sacred to one person may seem like utter nonsense to another. Nobody ever said that maintaining and respecting diversity would be easy. Now, as Unitarian Universalists, we know what it's like to suffer persecution. Some of our earliest leaders were martyred, burned at the stake, or sent off to die in caves. We know what it means to face injustice from those who believe that allowing us to exercise our freedoms endanger their futures because of their God's intolerance. I think of that slapstick routine of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson after 9/11 talking about, yeah, this is God getting back at us for allowing, you know, all these nasty liberals to have their way. That's why we often stand up for those who are on what liberation theologians have called the underside of history, the downtrodden. We know the challenge of sharing a message of hope and compassion when others would proclaim and insist upon a religious message that focuses on fear, hell and damnation, and human depravity. Let us hold in our hearts those people who are currently the victims of persecution in our land, those whose rights have been subverted for political purposes, and all who have been treated as disposable people, so that we can have our food and our clothes for the lowest possible prices, regardless of whether they work in dangerous environments or go hungry. They too are people with inherent worth and dignity. Let us treat them this way and honor it with safe working conditions, living wages. And as we sit across our tables or couches this holiday season, let us listen with understanding and speak with compassion to those who may differ from us. Through our love, may we tilt the axis of the world in the direction of greater compassion, deeper hope, enduring love. This is holy and righteous and religious work. It is our work to accomplish together. So be it.
4.